People nodded. Fine, fine. Though what was the point of having a committee if they weren't going to be given jobs?
Item 3, Isabel said. Catering.
Claire had been prepared, coming into this meeting, to do battle regarding the catering. She was so stunned after fighting about Max West, however, that she couldn't remember how she had planned to broach the catering question.
There were problems with the catering last year, Isabel said. Some people said their steaks were raw, and some said theirs tasted like shoe leather.
Claire tried to keep the eagerness out of her voice. Maybe we should switch caterers, she said.
Absolutely, Isabel said.
And for a split second, there was harmony. Palpable relief around the table. The co-chairs agreed.
Do you have anyone in mind?
Claire paused.
Did she dare say it?
I know someone who's interested in putting in a bid.
Who's that?
Island Fair.
Never heard of them, Isabel said.
Really? Claire said. She pressed her back against the chair again and did the thing with her feet and her pelvis in an attempt to keep her mouth shut, but that was impossible. The owner, Siobhan, she's my sister-in-law, said she catered a lunch at your house last summer.
Oh, Isabel said. Well, I threw a lot of catered luncheons last summer. I don't remember who I used for each one.
There was silence around the table. If the rest of the committee hadn't hated Isabel French before, they did now. Claire tried to keep her expression neutral. She had never had an enemy before, or even a rival. She wasn't used to feeling pleased when someone said something completely asinine. Adams cleared his throat. They're very good, he said. They cater the Boston Pops every year.
We don't want to use the same people as the Pops, Isabel said. We want to distinguish ourselves.
It would be different food, Claire said. It seems to me we want the most creative, delicious food at the best price, yes or no? The table murmured yes. Edward Melior piped up.
I think Siobhan would be great.
Let's have them give us a bid, Adams said. I happen to have two other bids here, though one of them is from the catering company we used last year.
Well, forget that, Isabel said. They were awful. Half our table had their entrees, but the other half had to wait. And by the time their food came, the rest of us were finished.
Things were looking good for Siobhan, Claire thought, and she'd barely had to say a word. Edward, will you take charge of catering? She asked. She knew he would pick Carter and Siobhan, because he and Siobhan had once been in love and engaged to be married, and everyone in the universe knew he still carried a flame for her. The only person who would not be thrilled about this situation was Carter. He didn't like Edward, but Siobhan wanted this job, and here was one way for her to get it without Claire's having to perform subterfuge with the paperwork.
My pleasure, Edward said.
Item 4,
Isabel said. Was it Claire's imagination, or did it sound like she was wearing down?
Auction item.
Locke had been sitting, this whole time, still as a statue, his hands folded on top of his legal pad. He had not written a single note, and he had not, as Claire had hoped, looked meaningfully in her direction. Possibly he was afraid to speak. He had a co-chair to his left who was making the meeting difficult and unpleasant, and a co-chair to his right whom he had kissed 2 days earlier. Claire was hurt that he wasn't placing himself solidly in her corner, but perhaps he was afraid to show his hand. He had feelings for Claire but couldn't let anyone know it, so he would let Claire flounder and take Isabel's arrows. Or he was exercising his usual good judgment and listening to everyone's opinions before weighing in. Claire should admire his impartiality instead of letting it bother her.
I have a few spectacular ideas for an auction item, Isabel said.
She did the tucking and tossing thing with her hair again. Claire was certain that none of Isabel's spectacular ideas included a museum-quality piece of glass conceived and fashioned by Claire Danner Crispin. If Locke hadn't told Isabel about Max West, then he certainly hadn't told her about Claire's coming out of retirement for the auction item.
Claire had considered bringing the sketch of the chandelier, but in the end, she had been too afraid. Art was subjective and always included the possibility of failure. Already there had been a few nights before she drifted off to sleep when she imagined Pietro da Silva, the island's best auctioneer, starting the bidding on her piece and looking over a sea of people, all of whom were sitting on their hands.
"Since we're not going to ask Kristen Chenoweth to perform," Isabel said, "we might ask her to donate private singing lessons."
"Singing lessons?" Tessa Klein said skeptically.
"Her face is plastered across every subway station in the city," Isabel said.
Edward Melior shrugged. "What about orchestra seats to the show with a meet and greet afterward?"
"Or dinner," Tessa said.
"I'm willing to ask," Isabel said gamely.
Claire's breathing was shallow. No one was going to want her glass. It wasn't sexy. It wasn't interesting.
"I also have a friend willing to donate his G5, Isabel said. "That's a private jet.
I could ask for a round trip anywhere in the United States with 20 people on board for a cocktail party."
"That sounds incredible," Edward Melior said.
"Incredible," Claire echoed. She felt like a complete ass. Locke had led her to believe that people would want her glass, but compared with singing lessons from a Tony Award-winning actress, or a cocktail party on a private jet flying to Palm Beach or over the Rockies, what Claire was offering up felt like a crayon drawing.
Locke Dixon tapped his pen against his notebook, like a judge with a gavel.
"Claire and I have already discussed the auction item," he said.
"And she has agreed to create a museum-quality piece of glass that we will put up as the auction item."
Claire felt her cheeks burning, as obvious as two circles of red felt. This was quite possibly the most mortifying moment of her entire life. Why had she let Locke talk her into this? She had no boundaries. Her cells, as Siobhan so adroitly pointed out, had no membranes.
When she looked up, there would be a table full of uncomfortable looks and throat clearings and scratching of heads, literal and figurative.
Museum-quality glass?
Huh?
Tessa Klein shrieked.
"Oh my God," she said. "Claire? You'll do it?"
Claire said. "I told Locke I would. I don't have an idea yet, though." Here, she thought, in addition to her cheeks burning, her nose would grow. Plus, let's face it, art is subjective. People could hate what I do.
"But you're a genius," Tessa said. "Claire has a piece in the Whitney Museum, you know."
"I told her this would be her triumphant return," Locke said.
He sounded, at that moment, proprietary and proud. And although Claire was elated, she was also worried. Would everyone now guess that there was something between them?
"Back after a 2-year hiatus."
"But Claire has a point," Adams said. "Art is subjective. I would hate to see her spend a lot of time and energy creating something and then not have it go for what it's worth."
"It would be embarrassing for me," Claire said, "and bad for Nantucket's children. If we didn't get the money, I mean." In the 2 weeks since the gala auction item had first been mentioned, it had jump-started Claire's career and caused a rift in her marriage. And now, Claire found herself backpedaling about it.
"We already have a guaranteed bid of $50,000, Locke said.
"We do," Adam said.
"Yes," Locke said, "from Daphne and me. Whatever Claire creates, we'll pay $50,000 for, and we can cultivate other bidders."
"Precisely," Tessa said. "I'll do a feature article in the magazine with a photograph, museum-quality piece. People will go crazy. The homes on this island have gotten so out of control with their movie theaters and their sculpture gardens and $6,000 shower curtains. I'll bet there are a bunch of people who would jump at a chance to own a major work by Claire. It would be one of a kind, right?"
"Yes," Claire squeaked.
"One of a kind. And she's been out of commission for a couple of years? That makes it even more special. I say we go for it," Tessa said. She grinned at Claire. "I say, go home and get blowing."
Brent Jackson laughed at this, and Edward Melior started to applaud. Locke said,
"Great.
Tessa, will you head the auction committee? You're the right person to get news about the piece out there.
Claire turned to Adams. Do you think it's a good idea?
You seem to have the full confidence of our executive director, Adams said. And Tessa is right about the summer people having a bad case of one-upmanship. The question is how you'll find the time.
Of course. Along with the waking nightmares, that was the question.
Claire glanced over at Isabel, who was quietly tucking her papers into her calfskin portfolio. What did Isabel think of Claire's creating a museum-quality piece of glass for the auction? Did she think it was a good idea or a bad idea?
I know your work.
But did she like Claire's work? Did she consider blown glass to be art? Or did she consider it a hobby, like pottery or knitting? Strangely, Claire found herself seeking Isabel's approval, her endorsement. But Isabel didn't respond. She looked exhausted. She had flown in for this meeting with her neatly printed agenda, but things hadn't gone her way. Claire should have been pleased, but she was plagued with self-doubt.
What if Max West was perceived as tawdry and common? What if hiring Siobhan to cater was unethical?
What if Locke was the only one bidding on Claire's piece? Did Claire really know how to run a benefit better than Isabel French, who had done it for larger organizations in the most sophisticated city in the world? It was silly to think so. If Claire was a reluctant victor, Isabel was a stoic loser. She crumpled the agenda in her fist in a way that seemed more resigned than angry.
I'm tired, she said, and starving.
There is still PR and marketing to discuss, but should we save it for next time?
Next time, Locke agreed,
and the rest of the committee seemed relieved. People packed up.
Dinner?
Claire heard Locke say.
God, yes, Isabel said. Where? I made a reservation at 21 Federal, he said.
Is Daphne coming? Isabel asked.
No. She wanted to see you, but she didn't feel well enough to come out.
Claire tried to remain calm. Locke was taking Isabel to 21 Federal for dinner. This really, really bugged her, but why? After all, Isabel had arrived from out of town. Tessa and Lauren and Francine were lingering by the door. They were waiting for Claire. They wanted to talk to her about the meeting, and she needed to thank them for coming. She should thank Brent and Edward, too. They had been supportive. But Claire could not tear her attention away from Locke and Isabel. Locke was taking Isabel and her beautiful hair out for dinner. Adams took Claire by the elbow. Let's go grab a drink.
Oh, Claire said, I don't know.
Claire?
This was Locke's voice.
Claire turned too eagerly. Do you want to join Isabel and me at 21 Federal? He said. We're going right now for dinner.
Did Claire want to go to 21 Federal with Locke and Isabel?
God, no.
It would turn into an uncomfortable extension of the meeting, or it would be Locke encouraging Claire and Isabel to get to know each other. Claire would rather go out and belt back a couple of stiff drinks with Adams and the rest of the committee. But she didn't want to turn Locke down. What if he took it as a rejection? Maybe she and Locke would outlast Isabel. Maybe they would return to the office alone or drive somewhere in Locke's car. If she said no to him now, when would she see him again? Would he call her at home, or would she have to create an excuse to swing by the office? If she swung by during the day, Gavin would be around. But what reason could she possibly fabricate to stop by at night?
Come out for a drink!
This was Tessa calling across the room.
We'll go to Water Street, okay, Adams? We'll meet you there.
Okay,
Adams said.
Claire?
Have you eaten? Locke asked.
Claire felt like she was being pecked at by chickens. But why? She could either go for drinks with Adams, Tessa, and the gang, or she could go to dinner with Locke and Isabel. The fact was, she could have stood there all night deliberating and still not have come up with the answer, which proved to Claire only one thing. She was losing her mind. I ate earlier, she said to Locke, though this was, of course, a lie, or a partial lie. At dinner with the kids, she had eaten the two puckered ends of Shay's hot dog. I should really get home. The baby doesn't do well without me.
Come out, just for one drink, Adams said.
Claire put on her coat. She was finding it hard to breathe here in the Elijah Baker house. She felt like she was wearing a whalebone corset.
Next time, she said.
She faced Isabel and Locke and gave them a believable smile, shook Isabel's hand, and said,
Thanks for running the meeting. You have my email, right? Well, if not, Locke has it. He'll give it to you. Or you can call me. I have to go. I'll see everybody later, okay?
Claire wedged her way past Locke and Isabel, who were looking at her as if she was nuts, which she was, and then around the table, jingling her keys. She meant it. She was leaving. When she finally made it out onto the cool street, she could almost hear the skin on her face hiss, the way a hot mold hissed when she dropped it into the water basin. She took her cell phone out and called Jason's cell phone. He answered on the first ring in a whisper.
Hey, baby.
She was so happy to hear his voice, she nearly wept.
Hey, she said. I'm on my way home.
Chapter 5. She surprises herself. Claire slept with Locke for the first time a week later. After the meeting with Isabel French and the committee, Claire walked away thinking, I am done with Locke Dixon. It was all adolescent nonsense anyway, and what were they doing? Two reasonable married adults. Claire climbed in bed with Jason and thought, I am happy here. I am happy. That Locke Dixon had showed an interest in her was flattering and would be left at that. How to explain what happened? Claire had always thought of adultery as a country she either wasn't brave enough or didn't want to visit. Until someone handed her a passport and a ticket, and suddenly she was on her way. Locke called Claire on her cell phone, which he had never done before. She was driving home from dropping the kids off at school. She had only Zach in the car, and he was drifting off to sleep. Claire was so certain it was Siobhan on the phone that she picked it up without checking the display and said, somewhat glumly, because she wasn't exactly giddy about giving up Locke. In fact, it left her feeling deflated.
Hey.
Claire.
It was him. She was flustered. She couldn't later remember what he had said, something to the effect that he knew she'd found the meeting difficult. It would get easier. Isabel would loosen up. She had been nervous and was going through the ringer with the divorce.
Okay, Claire said.
Right, I could tell. Whatever, it was fine. And then, after what seemed like a significant pause, Locke said,
Would you mind stopping by the office tonight?
Tonight?
Are you busy?
No, she said. Well, yes, always busy, but I can come in, swing by.
Great, he said.
Then there was silence. This was the time for Claire to renege, but she didn't. She could swing by the office. It sounded both casual and proper. He had something to give her. There was something for her to sign, proofread, consider. But she did not ask what it was. Okay, she said finally. I'll see you tonight.
See you tonight, he said.
Claire waited until Jason got home from work to tell him. I have a meeting tonight.
Jesus, Claire.
I know, I'm sorry. It should be short.
I can't believe this, Jason said. Why can't you meet during the day when the kids are at school and Pan is working? Why does it always have to be at night? Sorry, Claire said.
It will be quick. I'll be back by 9.
Promise?
Promise. After dinner, Claire gave the younger three kids a bath, got the girls into their bedroom with books, and dressed Zach in his pajamas. She handed him to Jason, who was zoned out in front of Entertainment Tonight. Can you make his bottle? Claire asked.
Why can't you do it?
I can do it, but I have to get ready. Get ready for what?
My meeting.
Why do you have to get ready for a meeting? You look fine.
I'd like to change.
Why?
Claire was shaking from anger, frustration, guilt, nerves.
Forget it, she said. I won't go. Give me the baby.
Jason scowled.
You're acting like one of the kids.
I am.
Go get ready for your meeting, Jason said. I'll take care of things here, again.
Claire went into the kitchen and fixed Zach's bottle. She couldn't do this. She could not leave her home, her kids. She could not even leave her infuriating husband to go to Locke. She wasn't cut out for it. It required guts that she didn't have. She felt something pop inside her, the bubble of expectation that had been expanding every second since Locke said, "See you tonight." He would be there, in the dark office, waiting for her. When she came up the stairs, he would smile. Claire brushed her teeth and changed into jeans and a cashmere sweater. She did nothing with her hair, and she did not put on perfume. Earrings?
No. Earrings would be a red flag.
Okay, she said to Jason. I'm going to my meeting. I'll be back by 9. He said nothing.
She hesitated.
He hadn't even heard her. Or he had heard her and was ignoring her. Stop me, she thought. But she only wanted him to stop her so she would have a reason to go in anger. As it was, she was going to have to take this step of her own free will. The decision was hers. Jason, she said. He was wrapped up in jeopardy. He waved. When Claire reached the office, she was shaking. She couldn't keep herself from shaking, even though she'd told herself that nothing had to happen, that it would all just be very innocent. Gala business. We insist things be done in an above-board way. Locke was at his desk with 2 glasses of wine already poured, but they didn't even get to the wine until afterward, after he had taken her, with insane hunger, incredible electric urgency, up against the wall. It was fast, animal-like. There was clawing and biting. They were like a pile of gasoline-soaked rags that someone took a match to. They went up in flames, whoosh, just like that. They were 2 crossed wires that caused an explosion. Boom. Hot. Claire had no thoughts other than thoughts about her body and what it wanted. He touched her here. He kissed her there. She could not get enough. She did not want it to end. His body was so different from Jason's. Jason was lean and muscular. He had 6-pack abs that he was very proud of. Locke was softer, pudgier in the midsection. His chest was hairy. It was so foreign to Claire. But his arms were strong, and he touched her with skill and desperation. He caressed her body, then grabbed it. He sucked, then bit. He was a man who had not made love in a long time, and his unchecked desire was touching, heartbreaking almost. Claire wanted to hand herself over. Yes, take me. Gobble me up, it's okay. She had landed. Welcome to adultery. When it was over, Claire slid to the ground, stunned, and Locke too, despite the lack of decorum, sat on the floor next to her and pulled her head into his lap and gently stroked her hair.
How are you?
He whispered. I don't know, she said.
Me either, he said.
I'm all messed up, she said.
I know, he said. She was grateful that it had happened so quickly.
So quickly that there had been no time for deciding. Yes, no, right, wrong. When she thought back on it later, it seemed like an act of nature visited upon them. A tornado, a bolt of lightning.
Locke.
She cried on the way home. Her whole body shook, despite the glass of wine, whose purpose all along, she realized, had been to calm her nerves. She was sad, because she had done something very wrong. She had betrayed not only her husband, but her own set of values. She was an adulteress. Then, too, she was sad because the sex had been amazing. It had been transporting. She was hostage to it, to him, Locke. She was sad because she had to leave him. He would stay at the office, get cleaned up, and go home to Daphne, while Claire would go home to her kids. And Jason. She said, "When will I see you again?" He said, "I'll be in touch." It continued. They met once a week, twice a week. They arranged it by text message or by email. Claire couldn't explain it. She didn't understand it. She was a captive of the country. Adultery. Locke had infected her. He was something she'd caught. He was a sickness. Maybe, like the common cold, it would wear off in a week or two. But maybe it would linger and grow like cancer. It would kill her. Claire couldn't decide if the worst thing about adultery was the guilt or the fear. The guilt was debilitating. It was worse than the guilt she harbored about Daphne, and worse than the guilt that attended Zach's birth. Those had been accidents, mistakes. They had been unintentional. This affair was deliberate. The most deliberate sin she had ever committed. As a child, she had memorized the act of contrition. "Oh my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended you." A priest once told her that sinners only thought about God after they had sinned, not before. This was Claire. She slept with Locke. She begged for forgiveness, as contrite as all the world, and then she slept with him again. Claire was plagued by memories of her own parents. Her father, Bud Danner, had owned an electronics store in Wildwood. He was a heavy drinker and a wild philanderer. He had not, in the words of Claire's mother, been faithful for 5 minutes. After work, he would go to the bar, where he caroused with a string of trashy women. Claire remembered her mother crying, her mother blaming herself, her mother so angry at her father that Claire thought she would kill him. She screamed, she threw things. He walked out. He seemed to have no shortage of places to go. And then Claire's mother would smack herself in the face again and again. It was awful. It was the worst thing Claire had ever witnessed, her mother's self-loathing. Claire had promised herself she would never be this way. She would not blame herself for things beyond her control. But of course she did, all the time. She had inherited her parents' worst traits, their most despicable behavior. She certainly never believed she would follow in her father's flawed footsteps and cheat. And yet, here she was. As Claire spoon-fed Zach pureed squash, as she bathed the girls and folded their pretty clothes, as she chose peaches and ribeye steaks at the grocery store, she recognized herself as a liar. She wasn't the person her children thought she was. She was someone with a secret life. Even worse than feeling guilty was forgetting to feel guilty. The guilt should have been part and parcel with the adultery. It should have been constant. To not feel guilt was monstrous. Guilt and no guilt. These were the worst things. "We're going to hell," Claire whispered in Locke's ear one night. "There is no hell," he whispered back. The only thing worse than the guilt was the fear of getting caught. One night, after Claire came home from being with Locke, Jason said, "You smell funny." Panic seized Claire by the knees.
"I do not."
"You do. You smell funny. Why do you smell funny?" She didn't look at him, though he was sitting up in bed staring at her.
"You smell funny all the time," she said. "You smell like cigarettes."
She got right into the shower. One day, she couldn't find her cell phone. Where was it? Claire looked everywhere, throughout the house, under the kids' beds, in the drawers in each of her purses, in the car, outside in the frosty grass, in the hot shop. Where was it? Had Zach taken it? She looked in the toy box. Had she left it at the supermarket? She called the supermarket. No one had turned in a phone. She called Siobhan. Siobhan said, "Call the phone, silly, see if anyone answers." Claire called the phone. Jason answered. Claire said, "What are you doing with my phone?" Jason said, "I have no idea. I didn't even know I had it until just now when you called me." Claire's stomach contracted until it was a tight ball of fear. This sounded like a lie. Had he taken her phone to check on her? Had he seen all the phone calls to the Nantucket's children office? Or to the strange number that was Locke's cell phone? Had he seen the texts? "Meet me here. Meet me there." Claire should have deleted them, one and all. She was such a bloody fool, such an innocent. She had not followed the most basic rule in covering her tracks. She got in the car and drove to Jason's work site, thinking of how to reasonably explain herself. The worst thing would be if Locke called while the phone was in Jason's possession. But there was an easy explanation. Gala business. There were always questions about the gala that needed to be asked or answered. Still, when Claire got the phone back, she erased every call with a sick and pounding heart. The fear was the worst thing. Claire wanted to go to confession, but confession was only held on Saturdays at 4 o'clock, and every Saturday at 4 o'clock, J.D. had a Pop Warner football game at the Boys and Girls Club, and Claire could not miss a game. It would be worse to miss her child's football game than not to confess to her adultery, she decided, though her desire to confess was pressing. She wasn't sure she could actually hand the truth over to Father Dominic, the priest who had baptized all four of her children and had administered J.D.'s and Ottilie's first communions. Claire adored Father Dominic. She'd had him to the house for dinner numerous times, and twice the two of them had gone to the movies together, once to see Chicago and once to see Dreamgirls. Father Dominic was a big fan of musicals. Jason could not abide them. The longer Claire went without confessing, the more convinced she became that she would not be able to say the words, "I'm committing adultery," to Father Dominic. She would have to wait for a visiting priest, whom she didn't know and who didn't know her, or she would confess to Father Dominic to a gamut of general sins and hope that adultery was covered among them. But somehow, Claire understood that confessing would not be confessing unless she confessed to Father Dominic about Locke Dixon. Anything short of this would be a cop-out and would not count. And so, she went. She left the Pop Warner game at halftime, telling Jason she had a migraine and had to go home. He said, "Will you take Zach with you, please?" She said, "I can't." He said, "I can't watch Zach and Shay and Ottilie and J.D. Ottilie was cheerleading, adorable in her N sweater and her blue and white pleated skirt. Shay was kicking a football on the sidelines, chasing it, kicking it again. Zach was whining, clawing at Claire's neck. Claire could not, in good conscience, leave Jason with all of the kids, but she had to get to church. "Okay," she said, "I'll take Zach." Father Dominic was stunned to see Claire and Zach sitting in the front pew when he exited the confessional. The surprise registered on his face. A slender, pretty young woman hurried out of the church, and Claire wondered what she had confessed, and whether it was anywhere close to as appalling as what Claire was about to admit to. Father Dominic said nothing. He simply gestured to the empty booth, and Claire carried Zach in and knelt. She wished fervently that she had been born a Protestant because at that moment, owning up to this enormous sin, saying it out loud to another human being, seemed a beastly punishment. She started in with the act of contrition. "Oh my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended you, and I detest all my sins." Zach clawed at her neck. He needed his fingernails cut. It felt like he was drawing blood. Claire took a deep breath. She eyed Father Dominic, whose head was bowed in prayer. She was trembling, as terrified as she'd ever been in her life. What was she afraid of? She was afraid he would hate her. He saw her, not every week, but many weeks, in church with the kids. He thought her to be a devout person. He had called her daily when Zach was in the hospital in Boston and had prayed with her over the phone. Now he would see her for who she truly was. "I'm committing adultery," Claire said. She expected Father's head to pop up. She awaited his aghast expression. But he was still. She was grateful for this stillness, this posture of acceptance. "I'm having an affair with Lockhart Dixon." Claire said his name, because not to say his name felt like holding back a part of the truth. Claire had no idea if Father Dominic knew Locke. Locke was a member of St. Paul's Episcopal. They might have known each other through one of Nantucket's children's programs. Father Dominic remained still. Claire closed her eyes. "That's all," she whispered. Zach started to cry. When Father Dominic raised his head, his expression was blank. In regard to confession, Father Dominic had once claimed that there was a hole in the back of his head. "People's sins drained out nearly as soon as they entered," he said. But Claire was pretty sure that wouldn't happen today. Father Dominic said, "You will stop. You came to confess. So you understand what you're doing is wrong. Will you stop?" Tears fell. Zach's and Claire's own. Of course he would ask her to stop or demand it. "I don't know if I can," she said.
"You can, Claire," Father Dominic said. "You must pray for strength."
"I can pray for strength, but I don't know if I can stop seeing Locke. I could tell you I'm going to stop, but I would be lying."
Father Dominic shook his head, and Claire felt an argument rising in her. It was the argument that ran like ticker tape through her mind. Did the adultery automatically make her a bad person? Did the good things that she did, caring for her kids, washing Jason's t-shirts, chairing a benefit that would bring important programs and enrichment into the lives of hardworking families, being a kind and thoughtful friend, helping injured birds on the side of the road rather than letting them suffer. Did these things count too? Or did only the sins count? Was there some kind of moral accounting that would put her ahead? Because she didn't feel like a bad person or an evil person. What, anyway, did Father Dominic know about heart-stopping passion? Zach was crying now. His cries reverberated against the walls of the confessional booth. Claire said, "Can you give me my penance?"
"You have to stop," Father Dominic said. "Then I can give you your penance."
She had to stop. She repeated this in the car on the way home. Zach screamed in the back seat, screamed and kicked his legs. His cries were echoing inside her. She was not a barroom urchin addled by drink like her father. She was a reasonable woman. She had to stop. By the time she got home, she did have a headache, so she took some Advil and lit a fire and poured a glass of wine, all with Zach snuggled against her chest on his way to sleep. She had a pot of chili on the stove, and cornbread, and homemade applesauce. At 5:30, it was pitch black outside, and the kids and Jason came home, their cheeks rosy from the cold and the exercise. Jason did not ask how she was feeling, but he did taste some chili from the wooden spoon and declared it delicious. JD stripped off his pads and his sweaty long underwear while Ottilie set the table in her cheerleading outfit. Jason touched Claire's back and said,
"This is how I always sort of imagined it. Our life, the fire, the pot of chili,
her children at home on a chilly fall evening. What was not to love? She had to stop."
Claire nodded. Her heart was a bad apple, soft and rotted.
Me too, she said.
Part 2. Chapter 6. He loves her. It was boom or bust, their business, and it was starting to wear on Siobhan. She slaved through the summer and fall, fielding phone calls from impetuous brides-to-be and their mothers. She woke up in the morning knowing she wouldn't see the boys for 5 minutes because she had a sit-down lunch for 15 people at noon, cocktails for 100 in Brant Point at 6, and a dinner buffet in Pocomo at 6:30. Could she really be two places at once? She would have to be. This all-hell-has-broken-loose, wild-ass chaos was slightly preferable to suffering through the winter and spring, making good on all the dinners for eight that Island Fair put up for bid at charity auctions, and constantly worrying about money and illegal staff and getting jobs and money again. The business made a profit, but life was expensive. Liam had hockey, which had cost a fortune even before he broke his arm and took an $8,000 jet ride to Boston, where he underwent 2 surgeries and incurred bills from a 3-day hospital stay and 5 subsequent weeks of physical therapy. That was behind them now, but there was the mortgage, heating oil, and Christmas approaching, and Siobhan was beginning to suspect that Carter had a gambling problem. The man loved sports, but that was hardly unusual. God knows Siobhan had seen a pub full of men, including her father and her 5 brothers, scream bloody murder at the telly when rugby was on, or even worse, cricket. Carter spent so much time in the confines of the hot kitchen, it was healthy for him to have some release, and Siobhan was glad it was sports and not porn on the internet. He was in a football pool, she knew that. But then, the other night at dinner, he announced that he had lost $1,200 on the Patriots game. $1,200! Siobhan nearly sprung a leak. She knew nothing about sports in this country, and even less about the gambling that attended the sports. But she had assumed it entailed a bunch of guys throwing $20 onto the bar. $1,200 was 6 lovely dinners out. It was an entire weekend in Stowe or New York City. Don't overreact, Carter had said. It's not exactly a fortune. It damn well is so, Siobhan had countered. She was the one who counted the beans. When Carter decided to quit his job as head chef at the Galley restaurant and start a catering business, it was because of the kids, because of the flexible scheduling, being his own boss. That was all well and good, but there would be no barter up in lifestyle if money kept flying out the door. For Siobhan, owning a business meant anguish and indigestion day in and day out. They did 1 big job in November, the private Montessori school dinner auction. Siobhan liked doing this dinner. Because it was her only big job between wedding season and the holidays, she was able to give it time and careful attention, and each year it was a masterpiece. This year the theme was the Far East. Siobhan dropped the boys at school and went straight to the catering kitchen, which was located in the back half of a commercial building out by the airport. It started to snow on her way there, which brightened her mood. Siobhan was a fan of layered sensory stimulation. She unlocked the door to the kitchen, made herself a cup of Irish breakfast, and put on a Chieftains CD, which Carter did not tolerate at home. The first snow of the year was falling in feathery bits out the window. Siobhan pulled her notebook out of her purse. She was in charge of the appetizers and dessert. Carter would do the entree. Her appetizers were duck, mango and scallion spring rolls for 100, sesame-crusted rare tuna on cucumber rounds with pickled ginger and wasabi for 100, and jumbo shrimp satay with peanut dipping sauce for 100. For dessert, she was making a complicated passion fruit and coconut cream parfait with macadamia nut brittle, which Carter called her crazy as Larry for even attempting. But hey, this was her masterpiece. Would he rather she was at home, picking up the boy's disgusting excuse for a bedroom,
or lamenting the many ways she might have spent the money that he had flushed down the loo with the disappointing Patriots? Siobhan loved Carter, and she had sworn on the altar that she would always love him, yes, but he was bringing her down. The tea was steaming, the Irishmen keening, the snow piling up.
"Don't think about a weekend in Stowe," Siobhan started with the peanut sauce.
Technically, Siobhan's mother had taught her to cook, though the porridge and cabbage and Finn and Hattie of Siobhan's youth in no way resembled the delights that now came out of her kitchen. She was all about flavor and color and decadence. She was Liberace playing poolside, candelabra ablaze, while her mother's cooking was like the parish organist, dutifully banging out another funeral dirge. As Siobhan sautéed onions and garlic and ginger in peanut oil, the phone rang. She looked around the empty kitchen, confused. It was the kitchen phone and not her cell phone, which was unusual. On her way to answer the phone, she saw the machine held 6 messages. 6.
"Hello?" she said.
"Siobhan, is that you?"
The voice.
She laughed, not because she was amused, but because she was caught off guard.
"Edward?"
"Hi," he said. Well, he would be more nervous than she was. Edward Melior, her former fiancé. They lived on the same island, which was 4 miles wide, 13 miles long, and yet she rarely saw him. Maybe once or twice a month they passed each other in their cars. Edward always waved, but Siobhan never realized it was him until he was in her rearview mirror. What was becoming more common was that Edward would attend an event Siobhan was catering. She had a way of sensing when he was going to be there, and she would stay in the tent or give the whole thing to Carter. It wasn't that she was avoiding Edward Melior. She just didn't want to have to offer him a canapé.
"Hi," she said. "What's up?"
"How are you?" He said this the way he always said it. "How are you?" As if he really wanted to know. He really did want to know. He had a zealous interest in other people. He remembered their names, their children's names, their situations. If they were thinking of buying a new car, or if they were caring for an elderly parent, or if their dog had just died. This was stuff he cataloged in his brain. It was unusual how much he remembered, how much he genuinely cared. It was feminine. But that was why he was a great and wealthy real estate agent. People lapped it up.
"Oh, I'm fine,"
Siobhan said breezily. She recalled the flowers Edward had sent to the house when Liam broke his arm. They were pink calla lilies, Siobhan's favorite, about 50 of them, fantastically expensive. She got rid of them before Liam and Carter came home from Boston. She hadn't sent a note for the flowers, which was monstrous, but dealing with Edward was tricky. He loved her still. He took every communication from her as a sign that they would reunite. They had been together during Siobhan's first 4 years on the island, when she was scooping ice cream and making sandwiches at Congdon's pharmacy. He was handling rentals at the real estate office upstairs. Edward was charmed by Siobhan's accent, which she found ludicrous. He fell in love immediately. Because Edward had far more money and knew far more people than Siobhan did, he assumed the role of Henry Higgins to her Eliza Doolittle. He believed he'd discovered her. Looking back, Siobhan was annoyed at how she'd played along with this notion. She became the pantry girl at the galley, and then the garde-manger, and then a line cook at lunch. Edward always referred to her as a chef, which wasn't accurate, but she never corrected him. He, meanwhile, had acquired a broker's license and was thinking of going out on his own, which sounded to Siobhan like a reckless idea. The Nantucket real estate market was a gold mine, a diamond mine. Brokers were printing their own money, yes, but Edward was such a good, sweet, accommodating guy that Siobhan feared he would get swallowed up. She came by this doomsday attitude honestly,
She was Irish.
Before Edward set up shop, they got engaged on a perfect autumn afternoon at Altar Rock. Edward had champagne and berries and melon and pink calla lilies, and he got down on one knee and presented a whopper of a ring.
"Will you be my wife?"
Siobhan laughed, covering her mouth, and nodded, because who would say no to such a beautiful, well-orchestrated proposal? It was only after the engagement was a publicly known fact, after it had been in the newspaper, after Edward's parents had thrown a party at their house on Cliff Road, that Siobhan began to falter. She didn't believe in Edward, and she realized that Edward didn't believe in her. Why else would he tell people she was a chef, when in fact she stood at a sauté pan for 12 hours a day, making goat cheese omelets and lobster eggs benedict? She grew less fond of the idea that she was a piece of Irish white trash that Edward had picked from the rubbish bin, and she became increasingly annoyed by Edward's interest in her every thought and mood. She had grown up in a family of 8 children. No one had paid attention that closely to Siobhan, ever. She yearned to be left alone with her interior life rather than to explain it. And, too, there was a new sous chef at work, a cute guy who had come from Balthazar in New York, whose knife skills put even the head chefs to shame. And funny thing, his last name was Crispin. Siobhan called him Crispy. He called her Trouble.
"How you doing there, Trouble?"
His first name was Carter, which made him sound rich, though clearly he wasn't, and Siobhan liked that. She was growing sick of Edward and his discretionary income and the way he bought things just because he could. This kind of waste offended her Irish sensibilities.
"How are the kids?" Edward asked.
Siobhan smelled the garlic and ginger turning bitter, and she hurried back to the stove and killed the heat.
"How's Liam's arm?"
"Fine. All better. Just fine."
Siobhan reached for the curry powder, the peanut butter, the soy sauce. She could chat and cook all day, but not with him.
"What can I do for you, Edward?"
"I've called and left a bunch of messages for you," he said. "On your office phone?"
"I just saw them this second," Siobhan said.
"Honestly, Edward, this is the first time I've set foot in the kitchen since Columbus Day."
"I'm calling about the summer gala for Nantucket's children," Edward said.
"I'm the head of the catering committee, and we'd like you to submit a bid. It's a bar bid, plus past hors d'oeuvres, sit-down dinner, dessert sampler at the table. 1,000 people, can you give us a bid?"
"I can,"
Siobhan said, uncertainly. She had several thoughts at once, and she tried to arrange the thoughts neatly in her mind, the way she'd seen Carter arrange cards in his hand when he played poker. She had been waiting for this request for quite a while. Claire had asked Siobhan to be on the gala committee back in September, and Siobhan had said yes, thinking this meant she and Carter would nab the catering job. But when Siobhan mentioned the catering, Claire backpedaled, and Siobhan had thought,
"There's no flipping way I'm going to sit on the committee if we don't get the job."
And so she hadn't attended any of the meetings, and Claire hadn't asked why, and the whole topic was left suspended. This might have made their friendship awkward, but Claire and Siobhan's friendship encompassed such vast territory that the summer gala catering question registered as no more than a tiny pinch.
"We'd like all the bids submitted by the first of the year," Edward said. "Though I won't lie to you. It's going to be a while before we decide. Most of my committee lives in New York, and so I have to get everyone the bids, ask them to review the bids, then find time to set up meetings. A decision will be made sometime in the spring."
"I'll fax you a bid," Siobhan said. "I'm doing the dinner auction for the Montessori this weekend, but I can probably get it to you before Thanksgiving."
"Great," Edward said. "You know, I was thinking of going to that dinner auction."
"Why would you?" Siobhan said. "You have no children."
"Well, you know me. I like to support island causes." Yes, she knew him.
She knew he would go to the dinner auction now because she would be there, and he had probably volunteered for the catering committee because he thought it would mean they would work together. Again, Siobhan's anger flared. Why hadn't Claire told her? Maybe Claire had wanted Siobhan to be surprised. Maybe Claire thought Siobhan would be happily surprised. Maybe Claire thought Siobhan wanted to have a fling with Edward. It was true that Siobhan occasionally mouthed off about having a fling with the produce guy at the grocery store or the UPS man, but that was just mouthing off. It was a way for her to throw darts at Carter's picture without actually hurting him.
I'll fax you a bid, Siobhan said.
Or drop it by my office, Edward said. He paused. We already have two other bids, by the way.
Will do. Thanks, Edward.
Take care, Siobhan. She hung up. That last tidbit from Edward was meant to be what? A taunt? Knowing Edward, it was purely informative. He would never do anything unethical, like ask her to sleep with him in exchange for the job. Ha! This was so outrageous, Siobhan laughed. Then the awkward feeling set in that followed each time Siobhan saw Edward or accidentally thought about him. She still had the engagement ring Edward had given her. It was in a secret compartment in her jewelry box, tucked into a blue velvet bag. The ring was magnificent, 2 1/3 carats in a platinum Tiffany setting. It had cost Edward $10,000. It was too big for Siobhan to wear while she was working. Had he not considered her career when he bought it? And so she had worn it on a chain around her neck for a while. But within the gritty, foul-mouthed funk of the restaurant kitchen, the ring had seemed ostentatious. Siobhan was afraid it would fall into the bisque. She was afraid one of the sketchy dishwashers would yank it off her neck as she walked to her car in the dark after service. So she started leaving the ring at home, right around the time that Carter Crispin arrived, and this started the fight that broke Siobhan and Edward up. When Siobhan and Edward split, the ring bounced around a bit. In one impetuous moment, Siobhan threw the ring at Edward. He picked it out of the crease in the sofa where it had landed and took it home. He returned a few days later to talk, but Siobhan turned him away. He left the ring in its soft velvet bag on her doorstep with a note. I bought this for you. It's yours. Siobhan had wanted nothing more than to return the ring, but she could not endure another confrontation with Edward. She mailed the ring to Edward at his office. Again, the ring appeared on her doorstep. Siobhan got it. The ring caused Edward pain. He didn't want it, and he didn't need the money he would get if he returned it. Fine, she thought. It went into her sock drawer first, then into the secret compartment of her jewelry box, a hiding place straight out of the mystery stories her boys liked to read. The ring, when she thought about it, irked her. It was like a pesky tag in her knickers, a pebble in her shoe, a popcorn kernel between her back molars. She should sell it, pawn it. It would still fetch thousands and thousands of dollars, which she, unlike Edward, could really use. But she couldn't bring herself to sell it, stupid as that sounded. And if anyone asked her why, which no one would, as no one knew she had the damn thing except possibly for Edward, she would say it was because she wasn't ready to let it go. Whatever that meant. Damn Edward for calling and ruining her pleasant morning. Damn Claire for meddling. As she was filling and wrapping the spring rolls, Siobhan called Claire. It was nearly noon. Now that Claire was back at work, she told Siobhan she was only available at lunchtime. Hey, Claire said, her mouth full.
Edward Melior, Siobhan said.
Excuse me?
Edward is heading your catering committee?
Oh, yeah, Claire said. Geez, I forgot about that. Are you pissed at me?
A little.
Well, don't be. He volunteered for it.
Yeah, and you didn't tell me.
I didn't want to freak you out.
What freaked me out was being caught off guard.
Well,
I'm glad he finally contacted you, Claire said.
You're going to give him a bid, right?
Yes.
He'll take you as long as you're lower, even a little bit lower, you know that.
I know. But I don't know what lower is, do I?
No, you don't, Claire said. I don't know either. I didn't look at the other bids.
No, of course not. You're as pious as the Pope's mother,
Siobhan said. She considered mentioning Carter's gambling loss, but decided against it. $1,200 was not the end of the world. He claimed it had been tip money anyway, his own discretionary income.
Don't overreact, baby.
If Siobhan told Claire about it, Claire would worry, and the whole thing would get blown out of proportion.
How's it going in the shop?
Okay, Claire said, still trying to finish the vases for Transom. They're not as easy as I thought they would be. And Elsa wants them in time for Christmas, and I have to start the chandelier for the gala auction. That's what I really want to be working on. Big sigh. Locke keeps telling me I'm an artist, not an artisan.
Locke has a warped perspective, Siobhan said. He has nothing else to spend his money on other than museum-quality glass. Well, and private school tuition, and wax for his Jaguar, and cufflinks, and Daphne's meds.
And Viognier, Claire piped in.
What?
Siobhan said. Nothing, Claire said. It's his favorite wine.
Oh, Siobhan said. Nice that you know his favorite wine. I wasn't sure Locke Dixon even drank wine. He has such a pole up his ass.
He does not, Claire said.
Yes, he does, Siobhan said.
No, Siobhan, he does not, Claire said. He's nothing like that. You don't know him.
Sure I do. He's as self-righteous as the born-agains.
Claire said, I have to go. Siobhan rolled up another spring roll. 8 rows of 8, 64. They were all plump and perfect, like swaddled babies.
Call me later, Siobhan said.
She hung up. Siobhan prepped the marinade for the saute, thinking,
Edward Malheur, pink calla lilies. It's too late to write a note for them now. It would look shoddy.
Thinking, Viognier, it's his favorite wine. Not Edward's, but Locke Dixon's. Locke Dixon kept telling Claire she was an artist, not an artisan. Siobhan was a caterer, not a chef, not a genius. She had scored B's and C's during her years with the nuns. She sometimes got so caught up in the mood of things that her common sense suffered. Her husband had managed to gamble away 4 figures right under her nose. Right under her nose. It's his favorite wine. Was something going on between Claire and Locke Dixon?
Never.
And yet, it sounded like it. But Claire was a straight arrow. She was all caught up with being good and kind and sending positive energy out into the universe. She was all about her kids and the lofty precepts of art. And besides all that, she had a sex life with Jason that was directly out of Cosmo. Claire would never have an affair. And if she were impossibly having an affair, she would never keep it from Siobhan. Claire told Siobhan everything. She told Siobhan about her menstrual cramps, her hangnails. She told Siobhan when the mail arrived or the toilet backed up. It's his favorite wine. Such a curious statement, and Claire had said it so proudly, so proprietarily. Claire and Locke Dixon? Never. And yet, it sounded like it. Siobhan catered the Montessori dinner to enormous kudos. She got Edward the bid for the gala. She kept an eye on Carter's gambling. She delivered the boys to and from their endless hockey practices. At Christmas time, she went crazy around the house, cooking and decorating. She baked figgy puddings. She made smoked salmon dip with homemade Parmesan pepper crisps. She did a gingerbread house with the boys, even though they had outgrown it, and did little more than eat all the candy.
Her gift to her friends this year was wreaths made out of dried hydrangea and the giant pine cones that fell from the firs out by Tuppensee Links. Siobhan went on several pinecone collecting missions, all of them bewitching and romantic. She wrapped herself in a candy-striped merino scarf and carried a woven basket as she wandered through the firs on cold afternoons, with the promise of Christmas carols at home and a hot buttered rum to warm her up. She was a girl from a fairy tale in those moments, as she gathered only the largest, most perfect pine cones, the only person for miles, alone on this pristine part of the island. Imagine her surprise when, on her way home with an overflowing basket of plump, piney beauties next to her, she passed Claire's car. Siobhan was heading out of the evergreen forest, and Claire was headed into it. Claire was driving way too fast, so that when Siobhan came around the bend on the dirt road, Claire's car was right there on top of her. They nearly collided. Siobhan gasped at the near miss, then gasped again at the fact that it was Claire's car. Claire at the wheel, with somebody in the passenger seat. A man. Locke Dixon. Or at least Siobhan thought it was Locke Dixon. All she could say for sure was that the man was wearing earmuffs, and Locke was famous around town for wearing earmuffs. Pole up his ass. Siobhan knew Claire recognized her car. How could she not? But Claire didn't stop. She and Locke Dixon barreled into the deserted forest that Siobhan had just left. Siobhan drove on, stymied. In the months since Claire had agreed to chair the gala, there had been two or three meetings a week, always at night. Jason complained to Carter, and Carter passed the complaints on to Siobhan. Seems a bit excessive, doesn't it? All those meetings. Don't you ever chair anything like that? Never, Siobhan said. It's too much bloody work. What were Claire and Locke Dixon doing driving into the forest together at 1 o'clock on a December afternoon? They weren't going to collect pine cones, that was for sure. Siobhan considered following them. What would they be doing? Later that afternoon, Siobhan called Claire at home, and Claire said, "Hey, how are you?" as though nothing had happened. "Did you not see me?" Siobhan demanded. "See what?" "Up at Tuppensee. Coming out of the woods, in my car. Jesus, Claire, you nearly ran me over." Claire laughed. But Siobhan was her best friend, had been for fucking centuries, and she could tell it was a fake laugh. "I don't know what you're talking about." "I saw you, Claire," Siobhan said. "And you had Locke in the car." Again, the laugh. One key off tune. "You're crazy, baby." Siobhan huffed. This was insane. She would know Claire in a dark cave with a paper bag over her head. "So, you're denying that you were at Tuppensee today?" "Tuppensee?" Like Siobhan was crazy. "I haven't been to Tuppensee since the dog died." She was denying it. But why? Claire could have come up with any number of plausible stories. Claire could have told Siobhan anything, and Siobhan would have decided to believe it. But to deny ever having been there when she had nearly crashed into Siobhan was an insult to the friendship, and stupid besides. It could only mean one thing. Claire and Locke were having a torrid affair. This was betrayal at its most exquisite. But no, Siobhan thought, it just wasn't possible. Claire was too much the choir girl. She had been born with a nagging conscience. She felt guilty when she missed a week of church, when she killed a housefly. She felt guilty when it rained. Having an affair was not something Claire was capable of. So what then was going on? Siobhan meant to find out. When he was younger, he used to pinch himself all the time. The money came rolling in.
But it wasn't the money that was exciting. It was the girls. So many girls. And guys, too, for that matter. And limousines, and rooms at the Four Seasons with their fluffy towels, their waffled robes, the Veuve Clicquot chilling in a silver bucket, the bouquets of roses, a garden's worth of roses thrown onto the stage. It was the deference, the respect shown to him by everyone from record execs to heads of state to Julia Roberts. She and her husband were fans and owned every album. Of Max West's. Matthew Westfield's. A kid from Wildwood Crest, a scruffy beach town in New Jersey. Down the shore. That was where Matthew had grown up, with a father who took off when Matthew was 5, and a sainted mother who worked as the church secretary and who got most of her information about life outside of Wildwood from the magazines she picked up at the grocery store checkout. What was he, Matthew Westfield, doing on stage with 70,000 people waving their arms in front of him? They were worshiping him. He was no longer a punk kid from New Jersey, but a god. He could have whatever he wanted. Women, drugs, guns, an audience with the Pope. He went once and tried to persuade his mother to join him, but she wouldn't travel to Italy, not even for the Holy Father. He was in Thailand now, in Bangkok, hunkering down at the Oriental Hotel. Outside his room were two butlers. They had these for every guest, and two armed guards. These were only for him, since he had cavalierly suggested that a Muslim girl in the crowd in Jakarta rip off her hijab for him, inciting Muslim rage and necessitating a quick exodus from the country. It was winter in America, but hotter than Hades here in Thailand. It was too hot to do anything but sit in the air conditioning, drink the chilled champagne, smoke the delightful Indo weed they took as a parting gift from Java, and just generally seek oblivion. Because wasn't it the sad truth that Max West, a person who could have whatever he wanted, wanted only oblivion? Sometime in the great black box, a poor man's piece. They had sent some girls up, a group skinny and giggling, wearing short skirts and noisy earrings and makeup meant for white women. They were all beautiful, but very young, a couple of them maybe only 14, maybe not even menstruating yet. They clung to one another like schoolgirls, and this made Matthew melancholy. He gave the girls a wad of bot and sent them away. The butler looked at him questioningly, and Matthew said, "Too young." Less than an hour later, there was a knock at the door, and a lone girl stood there glowering at him. She was older, 20 or 21, and she had a knowing, Western look. Jeans, a black t-shirt, silver hoop earrings,